the future of the Conservative Party is. So it's an interesting one, but a complete non-surprise.
Right, and just briefly, while we're talking about reform, now all the attention will be on that by-election, to go back to briefly the Gorton and Denton by-election, that reform could win it, will win it without Andy Burnham.
I think could win it in all circumstances, with or without Andy Burnham. People are talking about if Burnham plus tactical voting might mean Labour just about win it. I mean, it's for the birds if people think that incumbent governments, particularly one as unpopular as Labour at the moment, accrue any benefit from tactical voting. The tactic for the population in Gorton and Denton is, how do we get rid of the government and not allow the government to win the seat?
Yes.
So it'll be very, very difficult for Labour in any circumstances, with or without Andy. I'm afraid Andy's kind of sprinkle and magic dust wouldn't have been terribly effective there than any other candidate, in my opinion. Remember, it's only half a Manchester seat. The rest is in Tameside.
All right.
And Tameside will be grateful for people to remember that.
I'm going to cut you there. Tony McNulty, thank you very much for talking to us. That's it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright in for Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Joe, and good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
In the next 2 hours, more on Suella's latest move. Also, we'll talk to historian Dr. Eric Shaw about whether the Labour Party turmoil is really anything new. Despite the aches and pains that can come with chasing after young children, can you hear your knees creaking? A new study suggests grandparenting is very good for your health. Pet monkeys could be seized from owners who don't have proper licences. We'll hear from a campaigner about why the rules matter. And after 3:30, cheeky Robbie Millen, literary editor of The Times, joins us with the very latest from the world of books.
But first, let's get the latest news now with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Suella Braverman's become the latest high-profile Tory to defect to reform. The former Home Secretary's told a party event it feels like she's come home. She claims Britain is broken and said the Conservatives have no backbone.
We stand at a crossroads. We can either continue down this route of managed decline to weakness and surrender, or we can fix our country, reclaim our power, rediscover our strength.
Times Radio's chief political commentator Patrick Maguire says he's surprised she's been accepted given historic opposition to the move from within reform.
I'm surprised it's happened because I think there was an awareness for a long time at the top of reform that they couldn't become a retirement home for people associated with the failures of the last Conservative government, particularly on migration. Mm. And it's hard to argue that a former Tory Home Secretary puts clear turquoise water between reform and those failures. That is one perspective.
Sir Keir Starmer's defended his decision to block Andy Burnham from standing for Parliament, saying it would stretch Labour's resources at May's elections. The Prime Minister's asked his MPs to unite behind him after criticism from the left.
Yes, there is a fight, but that fight is with reform. And we all need to line up together to be in that fight, all playing our part. I think that everybody in the Labour Party, everybody who's a Labour MP, wants to be in that fight, wants to fight alongside all their colleagues in a fight that matters hugely to the future of our country.
Andy Burnham has criticised the way the Prime Minister's running the party and suggested Labour won't win the by-election after he was rejected. Several left-wing Labour MPs and ministers have described it as a stitch-up. Stephen Swinford is the Times' political editor.
I'm going to say that there was no right decision here. That what he's done will ultimately backfire. There's a very real risk of that. We are going to get this by-election in Manchester, and there is a very good chance now that Labour loses that. The counterfactual is if he had allowed Andy Burnham to run for it, they could have lost the Manchester morality, and then he would have had Andy Burnham in the ranks agitating for his removal as an MP.
The remains of the last Israeli hostage in Gaza have been found. The IDF has confirmed the body of Oran Gavili was discovered today. He was 24 when he was abducted by Hamas on October 7, 2023, as one of 250 hostages. He was a police officer. A coroner says heading footballs likely contributed to the death of former Scotland defender Gordon McQueen. He suffered with vascular dementia and CTE before his death in 2023. The coroner suggested those illnesses were caused by repeated heading of the ball during a 16-year career. And the latest named storm will be hitting the UK tomorrow. The Met Office says Chandra is likely to bring significant snow in northern parts of England and Scotland. Amber warnings for rain and wind cover areas of southwest England and Northern Ireland's eastern coast. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And a very good afternoon. It is a pleasure to be here. 4 minutes past two, Monday afternoon here on Times Radio in the company of Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, sitting in for Jane for the next couple of days. Well, today, as the Conservatives and Reform rejig another seat, what of Labour having, for now, blocked Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham's ambitions to become an MP and ultimately his potential dream to be Prime Minister? Does blocking Burnham solve a short-term problem but cause a much bigger one down the line? In Minneapolis, there have been two deadly shootings in the space of 3 weeks. President Trump has suggested he would be willing to eventually withdraw ICE agents from the city. How credible is that claim? And should schools be phone free? Now, as a Times Radio listener, you probably agree with the 94% of Times readers who said yes. Who could have guessed it, though? Teenagers are pretty good at getting around the rules. We'll see how hard it is to actually implement a ban that teenagers can't hack. You also now need a license to keep a monkey. The surprise may be, how did you not need a licence before now? Or that 5,000 people are keeping them as pets in the UK. And on the programme this afternoon, Deep Breath, we'll hear about the boost to your brain from being a grandparent, delve through some of the best books, and look at the challenges of being a buy-to-let landlord.
If you're a really exhausted grandparent, you may want to just lie down in a slightly muted room during that item. But there is scientific evidence that you are healthier than contemporaries who don't have grandchildren. Does that make it any better? Is half term already looming? It's 0333 003 2353 this afternoon. Anything that Rosie and I are talking about, we would love it if you were talking about it too. The most read stories on the Times website so far today, in at number three, Carlos Alcaraz told device he wore beneath sweatband is on banned list. The world number one has been told to remove the Whoop wearable technology by an umpire at the Australian Open. The second most read story, British mother, 33, stabbed to death at her home in Spain. This is a horrible story. Neighbours in the expat community called the police after Victoria Hart's children raised the alarm. The suspect has handed himself in. The most read piece on the Times website, Suella Braverman defects to Reform UK. The former Tory Home Secretary told a Reform rally she felt like she'd come home.
Oh, done it. Done it. I resigned the Conservative and my party membership, a party membership of 30 years. It's gone. It's over today. And because I believe with my heart and soul that a better future is possible for us, I am joining Reform UK.
Well, you can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need a digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can do that very simply. You just go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
All right, it's 7 minutes past two. Andy Burnham has said today he's getting on with his job as Mayor of Greater Manchester. That's after being knocked back in his bid to stand for Labour at the Gorton and Denby by-election.
I've said everything I think I'm going to say about that today. I'm very much focusing on my job.
Well, Burnham had suggested it'll lead to the seat being lost, with Reform predicted to benefit. Suella Braverman's defection from the Tories has given the party its eighth MP today, so it's been a busy political morning. Keir Starmer defended his decision, though, to block the Greater Manchester Mayor from running earlier.
Andy Burnham's doing a great job as the Mayor of Manchester, But having an election for the Mayor of Manchester when it's not necessary would divert our resources away from the elections that we must have and that we must fight and win. And resources, whether that's money or people, need to be focused on the elections that we must have, not elections that we don't have to have. And that was the basis of the NEC decision.
Well, Dr. Eric Shaw is a political historian, also the author of many books and papers, but including Discipline and Discord, about strife in the Labour Party, and joins us. Eric, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What do you think of the Prime Minister's justification there to say, look, it's too expensive, too disruptive, we can't risk losing a mayoral election? Fair enough.
Well, I suppose his strongest point is about the mayoral election and the cost it would incur and the possibility that Labour would lose it. But frankly, I don't think many people are going to be convinced that's the major consideration which weighed in his mind.
And when you say those many people, which people are you talking about? Colleagues or the general public?
Well, let's distinguish between the two. Amongst colleagues, certainly those MPs who were loosely affiliated with the soft left of the party, a significant number. And many party members, the soft left probably represents the largest group within the constituency parties. They'll be unhappy. But also, when speaking as a proud Northern myself, I think a lot of Northern people would feel that this is another example of London exerting too much control. And we mustn't forget here that Andy Burnham is a very popular mayor, and he's got many, many friends and admirers in Merseyside as well.
This is the point that was made on Times Radio Breakfast this morning, but Andy Burnham did promise to be Manchester mayor for the time he was elected to do the job. So how credible is he to then say, actually, sort of a bigger, better position has come up, so I'm going to take a swing at that?
Well, I think you've got to be realistic. Some might remember that Keir Starmer described himself as a friend of Jeremy Corbyn. You know, things change in politics. Any role holder has to say that he's going to continue in that role. But, you know, as circumstances alter, then the thinking of that person will alter as well. So I don't think that's going to be a really major factor.
None of this would have been a problem for the Prime Minister if he had a much more secure position as Prime Minister. How vulnerable do you think he is?
Well, I think you have to take into account historical considerations and contemporary ones. Historically, Labour Party is very averse, unlike the Conservatives, to regicide. It's very, very, very unusual that a successful attempt is made to remove a leader. And there is a sort of inbuilt cultural disinclination to challenge leaders. That's the first point. The second point is that circumstances at present are unprecedented. The two-party system has effectively collapsed. There's a major threat from reform, and the possibility of many Labour seats falling to reform, and indeed reform forming the next government, is causing, you know, very acute anxiety within the party, leading them to contemplate the move which previously they would have been very reluctant to perform.
From your experience charting the history of the Labour Party, would a new leader now be something that would help solve the problems?
That is a huge, huge question. A new leader could expect to have a boost which may or may not last a great deal of time. But the real issue is not whether you're just changing the party leader, whether you're changing the policies. And a new leader, whether it was Andy Burnham or Wes Streeting or somebody else, would be confronted with the same unpalatable choices that Keir Starmer is facing. And that, in turn, was a direct consequence of very, very foolish and short-sighted decisions made in opposition, and the Labour government is having to deal with the legacy of those decisions now.
Is there confusion from within the party? You've described those decisions as sort of foolish and short-sighted. There was so long to prepare for government, as was so anticipated and predicted. And what seems to have happened, there was sort of a wave of optimism that lasted a week, maybe a fortnight. And then so quickly what happened was the Labour Party painted sort of a bleak vision of Britain as it was today, and confidence started to ebb away pretty quickly.
Well, I think the error, which was pointed out by people like Paul Johnson in opposition, was that Labour's pledge is that it wouldn't increase taxation. The state of the public services was such that, as Johnson warned at the time, that even maintaining them at the present level would mean higher taxation. Labour in opposition did not prepare the electorate for the type of decisions which were unavoidable. Instead, it consistently gave priority to short-term electoral considerations rather than to longer-term considerations of policy rationality, and that is beginning to bite the government now.
Do you think then that Keir Starmer deserves to be as sort of historically unpopular as he is?
Well, there is a bit of a mystery about Keir Starmer's unpopularity, because most people say that he's a reasonable, decent, honest and honourable man, and precisely why that many feel such a rage against him is difficult to elucidate. On the other hand, Labour's performance at the 2019 election was not an impressive one. To win with less than 34% of the vote on a very low turnout meant that maybe one in five voters positively voted for Labour in 2020-2024. So it didn't have much of a buttress upon which it could fall when an inevitable loss of popularity occurred.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk and maybe compare and contrast in terms of popularity. Keir Starmer seems to be in a slightly challenging position where you've talked about the threat of reform. You've got someone in Nigel Farage who, sort of loathe him or love him, has lots of charisma. So too does Zach Polanski. Are we creeping towards a situation where the power of your personality actually is maybe just as important as your policies?
Well, it shouldn't be. But I think it is. I think that we've seen that in the case of both Farage and Polanski, most recently with Zach Polanski, how he's recharged and energised the Green Party. This is why a lot of people began to think of replacing Keir Starmer either by Wes Streeting or by Andy Burnham, both of whom are good communicators and have, you know, convivial personalities. Because party loyalties have disintegrated, that means that shorter-term factors influence the voter decision, and amongst those factors is how they perceive the party leaders.
Yeah, OK, so maybe personality in the shorter term is quite important. That kind of does bring us back to some of the differences, actually, between Andy Burnham and Keir Starmer. I want to stick with reform just for a moment or two, if we can, Eric, because of what's happened sort of in the last couple of hours.
Sure.
No huge surprise in Suella Braverman saying what all the people who are defecting from the Conservatives to reform keep saying, Britain is broken. I wonder what you think of this strategy to sort of play down the country as you join a new party?
Well, I think it's an excuse for thinking, really. I mean, it's just a handy phrase to use, a soundbite. It doesn't really mean anything. And it's a way of capitalising a widespread feeling of anger and resentment, but it really doesn't take us very far.
Nigel Farage has done something fairly extraordinary. I mean, when we had the election, four Reform MPs were elected, and he's now got double that number because of a lack of confidence from those Conservative MPs who think, do you know what, I think my chances are better if I swap sides. What do you think could happen between now and May where Nigel Farage has said to all those potential people wavering to say you might side, he says you've got to come, and before May we won't accept anyone after, and the Conservatives trying to sort of regroup and work out what their identity is between now and May too?
Well, I think that reform is on the roll. I'm no doubt that these defections have been carefully staged, and there will be some more to build up a sense of momentum. Given that a rather low proportion of the electorate tends to vote for local elections, mobilising the vote becomes very important. And the easiest way to do that is to employed people's sense of disaffection with either of the two major parties. And I think both the major parties are going to really struggle in the elections. And that includes in Wales. I think if Labour loses Wales, which is inevitable now, that's going to be a major blow, because Labour has been the largest party in Wales for a century. The chances of Labour winning in Scotland are fairly limited. I think that will be paralleled by equal losses by the Conservatives. And maybe some people began to think about the sense of an electoral system which so distorts opinion in what there's a 5 or 6 party system now.
Mm-hmm. Eric, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much. Dr. Eric Shaw, political historian, the author of Discipline and Discord, about strife in the Labour Party. It's surprising that he said, as a political historian, that any political outcome could be inevitable. Because you think, have we not learned, I mean, even in the last year, how dramatically things have changed? I wouldn't say anything was inevitable, I don't think.
What do you think of the phrase broken Britain when you hear it? What does it mean? Because I think the answer that Eric gave there about it's an excuse for thinking is a very good one, because it says everything and nothing, doesn't it? It's powerful to some people who want to hear it. I think it means nothing to an awful lot of people.
And if you do have a sense of discontent or frustration, you can then attach yourself to it and say, sort of a very sweeping generalisation, say, you know, I'm unhappy as well. And so maybe that taps into a wider sort of set of population where you don't have to specifically define it. I personally think it's quite a strange strategy to talk down your country rather than saying, you know, we want to be really proud of Britain. You can sort of say the same thing, but with a positive slant rather than a negative one. It wouldn't be a campaign I would support to talk down the country.
0333 00032353. We'd love your thoughts this afternoon. We've got some fascinating questions for you coming up in the next 40 minutes or so. If you own a monkey, would you like to get in touch with us this afternoon? We'd be very interested in hearing how they behave. You're going to have to get a licence from April. Don't worry, we won't be checking. There are 5,000 monkeys being kept across the UK. Surely that touches on the life of a Times Radio listener somewhere. Also, why becoming a grandparent could actually keep you young. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk, or why not just visit your local Wix store.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
I thought I'd seen it all, then felt myself awaken. I thought I'd witnessed beauty before my breath was taken. I thought that I'd known wonder, then sailed beneath these skies. I thought I'd seen the world until I opened my eyes. Change the way you see the world with HX Expeditions. Search Travel HX to discover more.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival.
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk. Thank you for all of your messages so far. What we can definitely say is that the phrase Britain is broken is a very provocative one. Christine says, when I hear the phrase broken Britain coming out of Nigel Farage's mouth, I think, well, it's broken because you broke it. Robert says, anyone who doesn't think that Britain is broken is either blind or only born within the last 10 years and thus not knowing any better. And Karen comes in with, I think Britain is broken is a terrible phrase. Negative, detrimental to cohesiveness in the country. Please include positivity in your messaging.
Yeah, Paul says, how can Tory defectors say this with a straight face, as it was 14 years of the Conservatives and their UKIP Brexit reform chums that broke it? And Robert says, look around at our institutions, services, borders, social cohesion. All are broken. You strike me by your comments as walking around with your eyes closed.
Well, I mean, you're free to comment any which way. Rosie and I were just saying in the studio that the problem with saying that Britain is broken, if you're a party that then wants to say we can be the party of business, it is a difficult thing to straddle. You've got one foot on the dock of the bay, you've got one foot on the boat there. So what's going to happen? More of your comments are always welcome. We remain Jane and Fee at times.radio on the email, even when it is the lovely Rosie with us. And Rosie is here for today and tomorrow. Make the most of her. Now, you might think that this is a ploy from frazzled parents hoping for some free childcare, but science suggests looking after grandchildren can come with a slew of health benefits for granny and granddad. According to analysis of almost 3,000 grandparents in England, grandparenting has been found to be good for the brain, slowing the decline of memory and verbal fluency skills. The benefits are said to be particularly noticeable in active grandmothers. Wake up, Grandad. Kaya Burgess is science and religious affairs correspondent for The Times. Hello, Kaya.
Hello.
Who conducted this study and what was their most surprising finding?
So the researchers were from Tilburg University in the Netherlands, published in the Psychology and Aging journal. And I suppose, I mean, perhaps it's not that surprising in the sense that if you want to stay physically and mentally healthy as you age, you want to stay physically active and challenge your brain. And I suppose running after a hyperactive toddler is probably a good way to do both.
And when we say grandparents, I mean, that can cover people who are possibly in their mid-40s all the way through to people who are in their 90s. So is it a sensible definition in a way?
Well, so it is. There's something called the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, and they looked at 2,887 people. They were all aged over 50 in this study, average age was 67, and they had taken part in this longitudinal survey, which is the best kind for this sort of thing, where they follow the same people over a long period of time. They ask them to take questionnaires and to take cognitive tests repeatedly over the period. And they just compared people who said that not only yes, they answered yes to the question of, do you look after your grandchildren sometimes? But they were also asked, how often do you look after them? What does it entail? Is it picking up from school? Is it helping with homework? Is it, you know, all sorts of different things. And they found that those who answered yes to the question of being actively engaged in looking after their grandchildren, the decline in their scores on all these cognitive tests was a lot less steep than those who did not have an active role in helping to care for their grandkids.
So, I mean, the word active can be confusing, can't it? So by active, you're meaning actually physically very active, not kind of just emotionally active in your grandchildren's lives.
No, active in not necessarily in terms of being a lot of physical activity, just being actually as an engaged grandparent, that you are involved in helping to bring your grandchildren up in terms of babysitting, childcare, homework, pickups from school, that sort of thing. So active in the sense that you are playing an active role in their lives.
Was there any evidence at all that if you do too much grandparenting, you might actually become as exhausted as new parents often are?
Well, that's what prompted it, I think, from the researchers. They sort of thought, well, it's exhausting enough running after a toddler when you're a parent in your 20s or 30s. If you're having to do it all over again in your 60s and 70s, is that going to be detrimental? And it did find that the beneficial effect for grandmothers was a lot stronger for grandfathers. And they sort of hypothesized that maybe for a particular generation who wasn't used to being particularly hands-on as a father in their own time, trying to learn those skills anew as a grandfather might be a little bit more demanding and seen as a bit more difficult, whereas it kind of came more naturally to the grandmothers who did more of it the first time round. And so perhaps that might explain that if you find grandparenting a chore, then it might not be so beneficial for you.
Sure. I love the way, just from your intonation there, Kai, you were treading quite carefully through the grandmother versus grandfather thing. I mean, I think a lot of our listeners, and, you know, we welcome the fact that we've got listeners of a certain age to this radio station, might think, yes, I completely identify with this. It has been great to be really involved in my grandkids' lives. But for an awful lot of people, they might not have had much of a choice in it, because that's the way the financial cookie crumbles often, isn't it, for parents, both Indeed. Of whom need to go out to work. Childcare, unbelievably expensive. Where do we look to? We look to grandparents who might actually not really have wanted to do quite as much childcare as they're doing.
So one thing that's really important whenever you read a scientific study paper is at the end, it'll have a section which will either say limitations, saying, you know, what this study can't tell you, or certainly it will say these are things that we'd like to look at sort of next. And this study that they used of these people who are grandparents had wonderful detail in it. But one detail it lacked was the degree to which their grandparenting was voluntary because they just wanted to do it and were offering the help. Or was it kind of an obligation because the parents had no choice but to rely on them? And they said it would be interesting in future studies to look at whether the mental health benefits, or rather the cognitive benefits, are still true for those grandparents who kind of have to muck in as an obligation, perhaps more than they might otherwise want to.
Yep. It is interesting in that regard, isn't it? And also, we should just always remember that it's relatively recent, isn't it, in the passage of humanity, that grandparents wouldn't be looking after their grandchildren.
Indeed. I mean, there are fascinating scientific studies about the degree to which, you know, the old phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, or perhaps thousands of years ago, a tribe to raise a child, and that, yes, child rearing would have been done collectively by that extended family. And even more recently, people would have been more likely to live in the same neighborhood they grew up in with grandparents and aunts and uncles around to make that sort of thing easier. Whereas now you might have to kind of commute a long distance to drop the kids off at the grandparents' house, which suddenly makes it that little bit more difficult.
Thank you very much indeed. Kaya Burgess is science and religious affairs correspondent for The Times.
I'm one of four girls, and one of the big considerations that my sisters will make, and lots of my friends, when they are buying somewhere, is where will my parents still be? Because it is baked into the assumption, really, that at some point you're going to need help from your grandparents to be able to have sustained two incomes and children at the same time.
Yeah. I can't wait until I'm called upon to be a grandparent.
Have you thought what name you'll be called as a grandparent? Because that can be quite tricky. Would you be a granny, a grandma?
Oh, I'll just answer to a whistle. I don't mind. Call me anything you like. It's got to be a little bit further down the line, though, because I do still have one child in school. Rosie.
Okay, right. So you're doing very much the parenting first. I think that also never stops, does it? So the parenting before the grandparenting.
Yeah.
Lots to come here on the programme. Has the government quietly changed its policy on bringing home ISIS brides? The Times has been looking to this. We'll see why. That is all after the news, though, at 2:31 now with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Reform UK now has eight sitting MPs after claiming another Conservative scalp. Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman has defected, claiming Britain is indeed broken and the Conservatives have no backbone. She'll represent her Hampshire constituency as a Reform representative with immediate effect. Nigel Farage has been asked why he's accepting MPs into the party who are part of a government he's repeatedly attacked.
There are people like Robert Jenrick who resigned as a matter of principle. People like Suella Braverman who spoke out on ECHR, said we should leave and was removed from her post. So we are taking people who tried their best to fight the system at the time and they admit they failed.
The Israeli military says the remains of the last hostage in Gaza has been retrieved. The body was of then 24-year-old police officer Ran Vili. The PM's defended a move to block Andy Burnham from running for a parliamentary seat, saying it would divert resources from the May election campaign. Sir Keir Starmer says he's doing a great job as Greater Manchester mayor. Three people have been charged over alleged chants at a protest calling for an intifada outside the Ministry of Justice. The trio were arrested last month on the same day police announced a change in approach to the slogan following the Bondi Beach terror attack. And it's been confirmed Nigella Lawson will replace Dame Prue Leith as a judge on the Great British Bake Off. The food writer writer and cook, says she's thrilled to be joining the team. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Life is short. The world is big. See more of it with Wild Frontiers. Experience the soul of Georgia through traditional winemaking. Find your Zen on ancient pilgrimage routes in Japan. Or enjoy a 1,000-star experience in a yurt camp on the Silk Road. Wild Frontiers' expertly crafted journeys take you further, so you can wander often, wonder always, and worry never. For small group tours and tailor-made adventures, visit wildfrontierstravel.com.
So, for my pension investment, should I pay a flat fee or a percentage fee? A percentage fee will get bigger as my pension grows, but Interactive Investor's flat fee will stay the same, meaning I get to keep the money I make. Obviously. It's
raining. For over 500,000 investors, the penny's dropped. A Which? Recommended personal pension provider for 4 years running. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore, II. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Are you dreaming of a new kitchen? Let Wix guide you through the wide range of stunning styles, appliances and worktops. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Get started by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
There's a massive amount of historical context coming in from Nick, who says England was broken before it was Britain. The sentiment is probably as old as humanity. It was a sentiment during the War of the Roses, not least when Henry VI lost a Brexit-style trade war with Burgundy. And, of course, things were better under the Titans, which was why Prometheus had to teach fire to mankind. I tell you what, they're stratospherically brainy, aren't they, out there? We're 0333 00 003 2353. If you are a new listener to Times Radio, and there are quite a few of you on board, it might be worth explaining where you can usually find Rosie Wright.
Very early. Very early. So if you're up early, catching a flight, maybe you're going to the gym or you've got to be up for work, or because your grandchildren have woken you up from 5 o'clock in the morning, it's early breakfast. That's with me Monday to Friday, normally at 5 to 6, to give you kind of a whistle stop tour of everything you need to know for the day.
OK, but we love it when you pop your head above the daylight parapet here.
So do I. Let me tell you. There is something very charming and wonderful about Times Radio at 5 o'clock in the morning, but it's very nice to see everybody here in the afternoon as well.
Yeah. What time do you get home?
Very early. Without revealing exactly my address, I'm just down the Northern Line and I can be home at sort of 6:35.
Right.
Yeah, so okay, as you're getting bizarre. Up to start your day, I've finished my work.
That is
day.
Bizarre.
I'm obviously followed by Kate McCann and Stig Abel for Times Radio Breakfast. They always have ministers, top politicians, and loads of other agenda-setting interviews. Then it's Hugo Rifkin, of course, who digs into the news, brilliant panellists. His How to Win an Election podcast goes live every Thursday. The Times at One, being presented by Joe Coburn this week. And then, after us at 4 o'clock, it is John Pienaar. John Pienaar's in the studio now to give us a bit of a glimpse. John, good afternoon.
Hi, Rosie.
Do you know what we've been talking about? This phrase that we hear from the Tory defectors to reform when they say, Britain is broken. And what you think the strategy is from reform to talk down the country in growing their party.
Yes. Well, that's a really important and interesting conversation, isn't it? Well, look, we've been talking in terms of broken Britain for years now. But I guess, you know, there is a part of that conversation surely needs to include, OK, this isn't working well, that's working terribly badly, but that's doing OK. And what can we do to make all of it work better than it is now? And after all, you could say that is what our politicians, no matter where they come from, ought to be for, to come up with solutions and not just, you know, the darkest of possible analysis with seemingly no way out. And that, I think, is you know, I guess to the heart of what you're saying there, isn't it? You know, politicians and parties with an interest in a political apocalypse, everything being flushed down the pan with no way back. I mean, people don't want to hear that. It accounts for a certain national malaise. And in many cases, it's not justified. I mean, I could talk about crime. I could talk about so many other things, which are not a simple, you know, awful black tale. But yeah, I want to hear more of that conversation. And you've been doing that. And over time, we all will be doing that. On the show that I'm on today, we're talking about stories which range from big to vast. I mean, we're going to be looking at Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary's plans to reform the police, which has been discussed and is going to be followed on the programme as it happens. In this country, we've got the story of the Labour Party. which is such an extraordinary story. And frankly, I'm looking at it from this position for the purpose of conversation. And Starmer may have bought himself a moment over the weekend by putting a block on Andy Burnham's march to the starting line of a leadership contest. But it doesn't change the fact, I suggest, that Keir Starmer is toast. And it's only a matter of when the crunch comes and who benefits from it. I've gamed out in my mind any number of scenarios on where this plays from here. And they all end up in the Prime Minister being toast. Anyway, I throw that in by way of a conversation starter, and I'm going to be talking to a lot of people about it, including MPs and some of our best political analysts. Also going to be talking about America, which in its own way, I suggest, is looking into an abyss, a threat to the very Republic, which has been caused over recent days by the shooting of the nurse in Minneapolis, a few days before that, by the mother. Both of them American citizens. And it's brought to the crunch a face-off between local law enforcement and local leaders and the federal government led by Donald Trump. And to talk of this as a threat to the Republic, it's a credible conversation and a credible danger. And I'm talking to local American politicians and other players too, and other things besides.
Excellent. We'll have more on Minneapolis actually in 20 minutes here this afternoon. John, thank you very much. John Pina will be here from 4 p.m.
Now, some important news to bring you this afternoon, that the remains of the last Israeli hostage, Ran Gavili, have been found in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the discovery an extraordinary achievement for Israel. Let's talk to Gabriel Weiniger, who joins us now. Gabriel, can you tell us just a little bit more about the search and more about the importance, both on a personal level and on a political level, of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So Ran Gavili, he is known as the first to enter Gaza and the last to return. He was captured on October the 7th during the Hamas-led attacks on the Gaza border communities, which killed nearly 1,200 people and took 250 captive, including Gavili. Israelis felt like they couldn't close a chapter, and the ceasefire hadn't really begun until Ran was returned. And it's a really core value for Israelis to not leave any man behind. And actually, that closes a rather larger chapter for Israelis of hostages held in Gaza over the past 4 years or ten years from previous rounds of war, previous kidnappings of soldiers. So there are now no hostages held in Gaza, which is a really momentous occasion. In fact, there's only one Israeli remaining outside of Israel who needs to be repatriated. That's Ron Arad, but that's another story. So in terms of Gavili coming back, yes, it's a very momentous time. It's come at a time of pressure, I think, for Israel, where the United States is pushing on Israel to conduct phase two, to get it started, to move forward the ceasefire. Yesterday, we had envoys Witkoff and Kushner meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu and saying this has to be done. Now that they found him, and it was a rather grim operation to recover his body, the IDF launched extensive searches in a Muslim graveyard in northern Gaza, believing on intelligence that he was buried wrongly in a cemetery. That turned out to be the case, and soldiers had to go through graves of some 200 bodies, exhuming them and checking them, which is, you know, traumatic also for the Gazan families who had to have their loved ones dug up and overturned and checked. So that was a very difficult chapter, I think, that many will be very happy to close. Now we're going to see the Rafah crossing reopen. That's been closed since 2024. So that's going to come as a big relief for Gazans as well, who are looking to return. Around 42,000 Gazans fled the war, many via Egypt. Many want to go back home. And it will also allow the entry of more aid into Gaza as well.
Gabrielle, thank you very much indeed for explaining that. And you're absolutely right. What a trauma. That's Gabrielle Weiniger, who was telling us just a little bit about that news that we had this afternoon, that the remains of the last Israeli hostage, and that's Ran Gavili, have been found in Gaza and returned to his family.
Now, British women and children linked to the Islamic State have been quietly brought home from Syria. That's according to the director of the camp where the former London schoolgirl Shamima Begum is held. He's told The Times 6 women and 9 children have been sent back to the UK. The Syrian government's currently taking control of many of the camps, which has led to some fears that inmates could escape in the confusion. Josh Baker is a filmmaker who interviewed Shamima Begum for the podcast and the investigative documentary The Shamima Begum Story, and joins us now. Josh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you explain these sort of most recent stories, reports, that women and children who are linked to Islamic State who'd been in these camps have been repatriated to the UK?
Yeah, so actually this is something that, believe it or not, has been going on for some time. There are roughly around 400 plus people back in the UK who have some link to ISIS. What we've seen more recently, though, and what this the latest story refers to, is that when the so-called Islamic State fell back in 2019, tens of thousands of people walked out of its so-called ashes. They were put into temporary camps, temporary accommodation, and many of them have been there ever since. And amongst that number were a great deal of children as well. Some were born inside the so-called caliphate, some were taken there by their families. And there seems to have been some cases recently, and also going back over the last few years, where a decision has been made to bring those children back to the UK. What is often a difficult thing for the government is it's quite hard to separate those children from their parents. So sometimes you see the parents and the child come back together.
And the obvious concern then is that those children have been raised on the kind of apocalyptic beliefs of ISIS. That's the nervousness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, look, anyone that has been associated with the terror group ISIS, it could potentially pose a threat. I think what security experts often say to me is actually the cost of doing nothing and leaving these people in these camps is potentially a greater security threat to the UK than not bringing them back. And that seems to be a sentiment that's echoed a lot by our European allies. You know, Holland has been very good at repatriations. And indeed, the United States, under Donald Trump, they took the decision to bring a lot of people back, prosecute them, put the kids back into care, rehabilitate, and then release them if they have no charge to answer for.
But what is the UK government's official policy?
So the UK government is very strict on its decision that it does not want to bring back to the UK any former citizens, because bear in mind, we took away the citizenship of a lot of these people, or British citizens, because they deem them to be a threat. So people like Shamima Begum, for example, back in 2019, Shamima Begum had her citizenship taken away because the British government decided she was a threat. So the British government has been consistent, whether it's Labour or the Tories, on that position. And that is what stands today. However, the situation, as you said at the top of this, is changing. And it may be that in the future we see that there is growing pressure, not only from Syria, but from the UK's allies, to take a different view.
And why is the situation changing?
So for a long time, the sort of ISIS detainees that you referred to were held under the control of a Kurdish militia. They were very much our boots on the ground in the fight against ISIS. They were supported to destroy the so-called caliphate. However, with the fall of President Assad back in December 2014 and the new government under President al-Shara, there has been a move to sort of reconcile the country. And so Damascus, if you will, has been pushing to retake these areas from Kurdish forces. And at the moment, there is a tense negotiation going on, a lot of fighting going on between those two groups. As the Damascus forces advance, they're seizing control of more camps and prisons that were used to hold ISIS members. And I think long term, it is going to be very unpalatable for them to want to continue to hold these people.
So what do you imagine is going to be the fate of the people who are in the camps who are from countries that are refusing to repatriate them?
So I think it's interesting. So as far as I'm aware, the Dutch repatriated seven people last week. They took them out of Camp Rog, which is where Shamima Begum is held, and they took them back. I'm not sure that's officially known yet. But I think the immediate thing is there will be some sort of status quo that continues. But as we go into the longer term, I think, you know, Syria is going to want to try to offload this problem from its country. You have to remember that tens of thousands of people from more than 86 nations joined this group. And I think Syria's viewpoint is that long term, it isn't the responsibility of Syrians to maintain these people forever.
And the government have changed their policy recently in terms of, they are now happy to resume the deportation of foreign criminals and failed asylum seekers to Syria. So the relationship there has changed somewhat.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that in great detail, but that's about essentially deporting Syrian citizens back to Syria, right? Or, you know, of that nature. And I think what Syria is taking the view of, hold on, these people were at some point British citizens, and is it right, essentially, that we continue to hold them? And the Kurdish forces for a long time have posed that question. And there is no doubt that these people pose a security threat, right? Nobody would disagree with that. But I think it comes down to ultimately whose responsibility are they? And that's the great question that nobody has been able to resolve universally.
And the most famous case of this, of course, is Shamima Begum, who I know you've spoken to. The question will be, why has she not been given the same rights as some of those other individuals, women and children, who were then allowed to come back to be repatriated to the UK?
Completely. I mean, Shamima and I have spent years talking to each other, and we're still in touch. I think the difficulty with her case is that, you know, she had her citizenship taken away from her. Pretty much every means within the British court system has been exhausted to try to overturn that. And that now sits with the European Court of Human Rights. And so her case is at the moment under consideration there. Now, if the European Court of Human Rights decides this does need to be reconsidered, that doesn't immediately mean she'll be brought back. It essentially forces the government to perhaps look at the situation again. And I think one of the things that I've been told that there is such resistance to Shamima's case is it's far bigger than her. If you go down the route of having to bring Shamima Begum back, for a lot of people, it means that you potentially have to bring back as many as 24 other families who had British citizenship at some point, because it sets a legal precedent. And so Shamima's case is about far more than just her. That said, her lawyers would say that she was 15 years old when she left the UK. She was groomed, she was trafficked, and that wasn't considered when the British government took away her citizenship.
Yeah, and we've had these debates many, many times. What did she say the last time you spoke to her?
Well, look, I think Shamima Begum has been consistent to me that she wants to have her day in court. She is not looking to come back and essentially be set free, so to speak. She has been consistent over the last few years about recognising her part in things, and she just wants to be afforded due process and come back to the UK to have that due process. And I think this is another point, that is, many of these people, no matter where they're from or what country they're from, when they're held in these camps for years, they are never put through a court system or anything like that. They're never found guilty or not guilty of anything. They're entirely deprived of due process. So there's a question about what sort of legal system do we want to support?
Mm-hmm. Final thing, Josh, for anyone who can't quite sort of imagine it, life inside one of the camps, and I'm not expressing sort of any empathy or anything here, but what's the reality like?
So for the women, if you imagine a sort of white tented refugee camp at the edge of the desert, very barren, very minimal, you know, not regular electricity, not regular water and things like that. And you have a very minimal existence. There are the dominant ideology in the camp is that of ISIS, and women who tend to push away from that find themselves to be isolated. And so it is a very limited and isolating existence. Now, for the men are often held in prison facilities which have appalling conditions. I've been to a number of the prisons. They're shocking. And so the conditions and the sort of life for these people is incredibly limited, far below anything you would find in a UK jail.
Josh, thank you for the context. It's been really helpful. Josh Baker, the filmmaker who interviewed Shamima Begum for the investigative documentary, The Shamima Begum Story.
It is 3:09. So Suella Braverman is the latest Tory to fall into Reform's welcoming embrace. It's led Nigel to text us to say, to my eyes, Reform are the equivalent of Snickers and the Tories a marathon. They're both exactly the same and contain lots of nuts. It's a historical confectionery-based joke, and we're very much here for that this afternoon, Nigel. We're 0333 003 2353. Coming up, do you have a licence for your monkey? When I got up this morning, I didn't think that's a question I'd be asking you, but you do need one from April. If anybody out there has a monkey, unlicensed or not, we'd be very interested in your experiences today. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The Story. the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is it that makes a Fred Olsen cruise feel like no other? Perhaps it's the awe-inspiring destinations that will stay with you forever. Or our ships that are small in size but big in character. It could be the wonderful people you meet along the way. Or our extraordinary crew. Maybe it's all of these things together. But if you really want to know what a Fred Olsen cruise feels like, there's only one way to find out.
Spire Healthcare gave me my life back.
The care I received was incredible.
Every year, over a million patients trust Spire Healthcare. See a leading medical expert privately in as little as 48 hours and get back to what you love sooner.
Spire Healthcare have given me a whole new lease of life.
And now I feel unbreakable again.
The sooner you're better, the better. Search Spire Healthcare today.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
This is Times Radio.
Oh. Wait, what is that?
That would be Marcel. You want to say hi?
No, I don't. Oh, he is precious. Where did you get him?
My friend Bethel rescued him from some lab.
That is so cruel. Why? Why would a parent name their child Bethel?
Sorry, I just had a crash at the beginning there with Ross and his pet monkey, Marcel. That was a tiny little bit of Friends. But if Ross was living in the UK after April, he'd need a licence to keep hold of his simian pal. There are more than 5,000 monkeys kept as pets in the UK, but only three, that's 03, requests have been made to local authorities since the application window opened a year ago, with rules including stricter requirements on enclosure sizes, indoor and outdoor access and UV light levels. Campaigners fear many monkeys are going to need to be rehomed or even put down. Well, let's talk now to Chris Lewis, captivity research and police manager, I think possibly policy manager at the animal charity Born Free. Chris, a very good afternoon from us.
Good afternoon.
How do we know that there are more than 5,000 monkeys kept as pets in the UK if there isn't a licensing system?
That's a very good question. And that is an estimated figure provided by the government. As you say, the sad reality is we have no real idea as to how many primates are being kept as pets. But the estimates do lay at around 3,000 to 5,000. And those are based on figures provided in the past by the RSPCA and other organisations working on this issue. But it is an estimate.
I think many of us in the office were just really surprised that you could keep a monkey as a pet without a licence. Do you think that this has been long, long overdue? And why has it been so late in being tackled?
Yes, so the sad reality in Britain as a whole is that you're pretty much able to keep any wild animal as a pet. There are very few that require a license. Primates will be one from April. However, what we have to recognise is that primates are completely unsuitable for being kept as pets in a domestic environment. The government's guidance on these regulations even acknowledges as such. So we do face ourselves with quite a frustrating situation where organisations such as ourselves, Born Free, have campaigned for over a decade to achieve a ban on the keeping of primates as pets. But we see that it will continue, providing that people are able to obtain a licence.
Why don't monkeys make good pets?
They are incredibly complex individuals, and as various different species, they have highly complex needs. That's dietary requirements, social needs, and also the environment that they need to be provided with. But when you compare what they have evolved to experience in the wild compared to what they're commonly kept like in a captive setting, the differences could not be more stark. So in a captive setting, when they're kept as a pet, they're commonly kept in a very small cage. They may not have any outdoor access, no access to UV light, which is vital to their bone health, and also they're often fed diets which are completely unsuitable for their nutritional needs.
Only three requests have gone in for official licences to local authorities. What do you make of that? What does that tell you?
Well, there's many issues that have resulted in only three applications being made. The first is that successive governments have fundamentally failed to make the public aware that these regulations even exist. They were introduced a couple of years ago to much fanfare. The government at the time gave themselves a pat on the back for introducing the regulations, and since then it's gone very quiet. And we now find ourselves with only three applications being made, and the regulations are at risk of failing before they even begin. But the other big issue as well, which we must emphasise, is these regulations were written as if there were no primates being kept as pets and it was a blank slate. But in reality, there are thousands of primates being kept, and the regulations mean that if people do not meet the needs or the requirements of these regulations, they cannot keep their primates anymore. That there's no grandfather clause that we sometimes refer to as, where people who perhaps cannot meet the standards may be allowed to keep their animal, providing they meet certain welfare criteria. But that doesn't exist in these regulations. It's simply either you meet the requirements or you will be fined and potentially have your animal seized, which we feel the majority of owners keeping primates at the moment will not meet these new regulations. And that is probably why many haven't come forward for that reason as well.
OK, so this is just bad news for the primates. It's bad news for the monkeys, isn't it?
Well, the issue is it was already bad news for these primates that were being kept as pets in the first place. These regulations were made with the aim of trying to improve those standards. However, if people don't engage with the regulations, we'll find ourselves in a situation that's been occurring for the last 10 years or more.
Chris, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. That's Chris Lewis, who is Captivity Research and Policy Manager at the animal charity Born Free.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And a very good afternoon. It's now 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. Coming up here, President Trump has suggested that ICE could soon leave Minneapolis. We'll get the latest there. We'll dip into the ongoing debate about whether social media should be banned for under-16s with the former vice president at Twitter. We'll hear from the Times literary editor, Robbie Millen, on all the books that should be on your reading list. And our money man, Adam Shaw, will be here to take us through the curious world of buy-to-lets. First, though, let's get the very latest news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman has defected to Reform UK. The Fareham and Waterlooville MP says the Conservatives have no backbone and claim Britain is broken. It comes on the heels of Robert Jenrick switching 11 days ago and brings the number of sitting members of Parliament in Reform to 8. Mrs Braverman used the opportunity at a Reform event in central London to attack her former party.
When they're sat behind that table making the difficult decisions for the country, they fold. When push comes to shove, they go AWOL. No courage, no backbone, no resolve.
Her fellow defector, Mr Jenrick, gave his reaction to Talk.
Suella is an old friend of mine and somebody I've admired for a long time. So I'm delighted that she's made the same decision that I have. These are hard decisions, but like me, she's chosen to put party loyalty to one side and put country first, because we both believe that this is the only way in which we'll be able to fix this country.
Meanwhile, Nigel Farage has admitted it would have been hard to beat Andy Burnham in the Gordon and Denton by-election. Sir Keir Starmer said fighting an election for the Mayor of Greater Manchester, if Andy Burnham stood down, would divert attention from other important elections in May. Times Radio presenter and former Labour adviser Baroness Ayesha Hazarika says the Prime Minister's dilemma was a tricky one.
I would have liked to have seen Keir Starmer say, do you know what, Andy, I want my best players, come on in, I'm going to give you a big role, but if you come at me and if you are disloyal, that's going to reflect really badly on you. And I think that would have reflected badly on Andy with the PLP and with the membership if Keir Starmer had been benevolent and looked strong. But again, that's high risk.
The Gordon and Denton by-election will be held in a month's time on the 26th of February. Israeli officials have recovered the body of the last remaining hostage taken during the October 7th attacks. Ran Gvili was a 24-year-old police officer. Middle East correspondent Yotam Confino is based in Israel.
His family is very relieved. They're thanking the IDF, obviously, for doing what they could. And I would say there's a sense of relief now in Gaza, in Israel, I assume also in Gaza, that you can finally move on from this.
Hamas was meant to return all hostages, alive and dead, within 72 hours of the ceasefire taking effect in October. Three people have been charged over alleged chants at a protest calling for an intifada. The trio, aged between 21 and 60, were arrested outside the Ministry of Justice on December the 17th, the same day police announced a change in approach to the slogan following the terror attack on Bondi Beach. They'll appear before magistrates next month. More than 500 people have contacted police reporting sexual abuse during military medical examinations. Wiltshire police say the allegations span decades and involve the Army, Navy and Air Force. Ministers have called the scale deeply disturbing and are urging anyone affected to come forward. And the latest storm will be hitting the UK tomorrow. The Met Office says Chandra's likely to bring significant snow in northern parts of England and Scotland. Amber warnings for rain and wind cover areas of southwest England and Northern Ireland's eastern coast. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms.
Well, if you're looking for purpose in the current circus, if you're seeking respect and attention, if you're in need of a gig that'll make you feel big, come with me and put some folks in detention. Just last week was kind of tough, I put a kid in cuffs, I zip-tied a lady to a van. We can sneak around town hunting working folks down. I hear they got a great benefit plan. Join ICE, boy ain't it nice. Join ICE, take my advice.
Well, it is called Join ICE and it's a protest song by Jesse Wells, billed by many as a modern Bob Dylan. He's satirising what an increasing number of Americans seem to feel about a federal force that's opaque over its remit, its actions and its ability to be held to proper account. Now, President Trump has suggested he would be willing to eventually withdraw ICE agents from Minneapolis, but that is after praising the work of officers in the area, saying they're doing a phenomenal job. And it's just days after Alex Pretty, a nurse, was killed during protests against the enforcement operation. That is the second deadly shooting by federal officers in less than 3 weeks. Let's talk to Brian Baxt, who's political editor for Minnesota Public Radio News, based in the state's capital of St. Paul. A very good afternoon from us, Brian, from London. Can you tell us what the situation is on the streets there at the moment?
Things are really tense, and folks are both they're remorseful about what has happened to some of their citizen neighbors, and they're also just angry about this continued incursion of federal authorities here in Minneapolis and around the state. There's about 3,000 federal authorities involved in the immigration action, both Border Patrol and ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security here in the United States. And again, you've mentioned it, there have been two fatal shootings, one non-fatal shooting by an ICE officer in the time that they've been here in Minnesota for this last several weeks. And just to put that in context, there have been three homicides in Minneapolis all year. So two of the three involve federal immigration agents.
How would you describe the protests against ICE? The description from the Trump administration varies, doesn't it? But the theme is that this is agents of domestic terrorism. How would you describe them?
What's going on the ground does not overlap with what is being portrayed here. I mean, just on Friday, there were 15 to 20,000 people peacefully marching through the streets of Minneapolis. There have been other peaceful protests, vigils at the sites of both of these fatal shootings. There have been clashes, no doubt. And there have been locations in the city, particularly at the building where a lot of the headquarters of the immigration action are. But the amount of clashes have been relatively few compared to the number of people who are getting out to protest.
Can you explain to us here in the UK the balance of power between ICE and a state police force and ICE and any kind of state legislation?
Well, just, you know, as I mentioned, there are more than 3,000 federal authorities here. And the size of the city of Minneapolis, which where a lot of these efforts are concentrated, their police force is about 600. So their resources have been stretched really thin. And if you hear from the Trump administration, they're asking, why aren't the local police forces doing more to protect our agents? Well, they're not getting advance notice of where these operations are cropping up, and they're having to come in when things get out of hand. The state has mobilized the National Guard, which is the military arm, but mostly for crowd control. They were at one of these protest scenes the other day, handing out donuts and coffee. So they're trying to make sure that they're distinguishing themselves from the federal authorities. They don't want to be seen as part of the operation.
We have seen protesters shouting, "Go home," at the ICE agents. I mean, where is home for these agents? How much do you know about who's behind the masks?
We don't know much, and it's because of the masks and because they're not carrying identification. They're not wearing body cameras as many police do in the United States. There are some people who are definitely from the area. We've seen people, one of the agents involved in one of these fatal shootings has a home in the Minnesota area, but a lot of them don't. And so they're being brought in. And that's also adding to the tensions here, is that people, they're confused about where they are at times, and they don't really kind of communicate very well with people they come into contact with.
Can I just ask you very briefly before we let you go, Brian, what you think is going to happen? I mean, the weather is against everybody at the moment, isn't it, in your state, with temperatures dropping to minus 30 overnight. That usually prevents high levels of protest, but you are still seeing them, aren't you?
Minnesotans are pretty hardy. This is nothing to them to be out there in the cold. There are two big court hearings today, one of them by the state brought a lawsuit against the federal government seeking to have ICE move out. And so we'll be watching that one very closely.
Brian, thank you very much indeed. We really appreciate your time. That's Brian Bax to us from Minnesota Public Radio News. Let's talk now to David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump. Mr. Johnston, a good afternoon from us here in London. First of all, what do you make of President Trump's response to the death of Alex Pretty? Do you think it will be something that he comes to regret?
Donald doesn't regret. Donald, in his own mind, doesn't make mistakes. Everything he does is perfect. And for the nearly 40 years I've known and covered Donald, I've seen him make only one admission of a mistake. He said he never should have left the White House in 2021. So he's not going to regret this. It's just not his nature.
Is it a watershed moment, though? Mr. Pretty was carrying a gun that he was permitted to carry. He was engaged in a protest he was allowed to be engaged in. Both of those are written in the Constitution. He was an intensive care nurse. Within hours, he was being called an assassin by the Trump administration.
Yeah, the Trump administration supports these U.S. Supreme Court decision we have in the U.S. and the local laws that say anybody can carry any kind of gun anywhere, concealed or open, depending on state law. And some of the most liberal gun laws in America are in Minnesota. The gun carried by this nurse was under his coat and not accessible. It was removed by an ICE agent when the nurse went to help a woman who had been gratuitously thrown to the pavement by ICE officers, and he went to render assistance. They took the gun from him when they realized he had one under his coat, and then he is shot in the back of the head, and there are 10 shots fired. As someone who's written a lot about police tactics, got a nearly perfect score in LAPD pistol combat training. This is shocking. That's not how law enforcement behaves. And of course, Keith Ellison, the elected attorney general, has said that he is pursuing a criminal investigation. And if the facts warrant it, anticipates that the shooter is going to be convicted and sent to prison.
Yeah. What do you think will happen in the meantime?
Well, they're going to continue these provocative efforts. Now, there have been two very interesting developments here. One is a letter from Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of the United States, saying that ICE will be withdrawn if certain conditions are met. And one of them is giving the federal government access to Minnesota voter rolls, which makes it clear this is not about removing people who are in the United States illegally and are subject to deportation orders. A number of people who've been grabbed, you know, are include U.S. citizens who've been deported, removed from the country, and others who have committed no crime, who've been in complete compliance with the law and have limited permission to be here. The second important development here is that the Trump administration is prejudging all of this. And the signal they're sending is that our agents are immune from any accountability. They can do whatever they think they should do, and we're going to back them up. Normally, the leader of a political unit would say after a troublesome shooting, well, we have to find out all the facts, and then we will act appropriately. Here, they are issuing statements at variance with the facts and clearing people before there can be any investigation.
And this point about who actually makes up the ICE workforce, I mean, there are growing questions, aren't there, across America about who these people actually are. That doesn't go away, does it?
No. And presuming that we get back our democracy in America, because we've been living, in my view, under a dictatorship since February of last year when Donald declared himself, as I warned as early as 2011, he would do. But assuming we get our dictatorship back, we will eventually find out who these ICE agents are. And you can be virtually certain that they are going to include convicted wife beaters, domestic violence, other crimes, and people who were pardoned by Donald Trump after the effort to overthrow our government on January 6th of 2021.
But given everything that you've said there, does it still hold true that it doesn't damage Trump?
Oh, Trump is being damaged very heavily by this. There are two wedges that are pulling people away from Trump. One of them is his bellicose statements that would get us into foreign wars when he promised no more of these foreign entanglements. That's an important element to many people in the MAGA base, which is, by the way, only 20 or 25% of American adults. Secondly, there are a lot of people who see the tactics being used by ICE as not only just bad police tactics, but completely offensive to them. You know, grabbing little children on the way to school, pulling mothers and pregnant mothers out of cars, leaving small children in the back seat with the engine running on the road, things like that. And Trump's approval rating in the most recent credible poll is about 32%. With a 58% disapproval rating, his numbers are falling. That does not mean, however, that that will put the Democrats back in control of the House or the Senate. The American Democrats have a long history of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
So given all of that, and this is a man who ultimately cares about his popularity and his power base very much, why do you think, David, that he allows his administration to badmouth dead people? J.D. Vance in particular, Kirsty Noem has joined in too. There doesn't seem to be a connection between him stating, yes, there will be a review, and the immediate response that comes from other people purely directed at making people believe that these are criminals who've been killed. It doesn't add up at all.
No. Well, disregard for others is a hallmark of Donald Trump throughout his career. Whether he's cheating investors or even gamblers at one of his casinos, not paying bills or anything else, attacking John McCain, who was shot down in the Vietnam War and served time in a prisoner of war camp. Attacking other people, you're not legitimate, you don't matter, is just a hallmark of Donald, who regards himself as special and unique, and he alone can save us, his words, not mine. So this is not surprising. Donald believes that he is imbued with special powers and that he should run the whole world. And in fact, when I said that he believed that in 2011 and some people mocked it, lo and behold, in 2025, he said it in an on-the-record interview with The Atlantic magazine. So Donald is seeking here absolute power. The effort by ICE is clearly designed to inflame the public, to create a circumstance that would allow Trump to suspend the right of habeas corpus, the right to be brought before a magistrate if you're seized, and to impose some version of martial law under the Insurrection Act. The demonstrations so far, as I've seen them on television, and I've covered, I can't tell you how many demonstrations in the last 60 years, appear absolutely normal and peaceful, but they are so determined, Fee, that they sought arrest warrants, the federal government did, for 8 people who invaded a church whose pastor is an ICE agent. Dumb move, strategically or tactically, but at worst, disorderly conduct. The judge magistrate who heard this matter only approved 3 of the 8 requested warrants, whereupon the Justice Department said, no, you must issue these, which means the judiciary is not independent, and said that it was a matter of national security. So they're willing to say if you go in and disrupt a church service to yell at people and then leave without hurting anybody, just exchanging hot words, that you are a national security risk. And there are many videotapes now, cell phone videos of people where ICE agents say to them, you're now a domestic terrorist. We got your identity. We know who you are. This is an effort to suppress freedom.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He is also the author of The Making of Donald Trump. I will come to some of your thoughts about this in a couple of moments' time. I will start with just one quick one from Mary, who says that's another American telling the truth.
Yeah, what's very challenging about this story is Donald Trump's given no time frame for when those ICE officials might actually leave. He just said, at some point we will leave. They've done a phenomenal job. That's what he said to the Wall Street Journal. And yet Mary messaging in to say, look, another American telling the truth, but lots of, you just get a glimpse already at this point of how divisive this is. Chris says, this is President Trump. You may dislike him on your left-wing show, but afford him and the office some respect. You may be aware he won a big victory at the election. Mike said, what is really frightening is that Trump cannot backtrack on ICE as he'll look weak to the MAGA movement. That could affect his midterm results. He's painting himself into a corner where his only option is to double down and escalate. He has no choice.
I think what's very striking about this, which hasn't appeared in previous edicts in the Trump administration, is just what the people of Minnesota have been trying to say, which is we don't know who these people are who've come in to police our community. We don't know their identities. They are not under the same kind of rigorous, and you can debate whether or not that happens normally in America, officialdom that other police forces might be. You know, the evidence against them is being filmed by other people. It is not on their own cameras. It does seem to be a slightly parallel universe. That's not me saying it. That is the protesters of Minnesota who don't want these people in their community.
And the protesters saying we cannot be sure. The protesters saying this, that these officials are keeping the law.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why you see thousands of them out on the street protesting, despite the fact that the temperatures are quite so bleak, as you mentioned, Fee. There'll be more on this on John Pienaar's programme. He's here in 40 minutes at 4 o'clock here on Times Radio. Before that, though, a question you may think there's an obvious answer to. Is social media designed to get you addicted? Well, exactly how so? The former vice president of Twitter will be here. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Spire Healthcare gave me my life back.
The care I received was incredible.
Every year, over 1 million patients trust Spire Healthcare. See a leading medical expert privately in as little as 48 hours and get back to what you love sooner.
Spire Healthcare have given me a whole new lease of life.
And now I feel unbreakable again.
The sooner you're better, the better. Search Spire Healthcare today.
What is it that makes a Fred Olsen cruise feel like no other? Perhaps it's the awe-inspiring destinations that will stay with you forever. Or our ships that are small in size but big in character. It could be the wonderful people you meet along the way. Or our extraordinary crew. Maybe it's all of these things together. But if you really want to know what a Fred Olsen cruise feels like, there's only one way to find out.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in bathrooms. From a shiny new tap to a full bathroom renovation, Wix has everything you need for every style of home. Browse thousands of bathroom products at wix.co.uk.
22 minutes past three. Now, if you look at what apps you use most on your phone, how many of them are social media? Are you happy about how much time you spend on them? I think probably the answer is no. Well, tech bosses at companies including Meta, TikTok and YouTube are being sued in the US over allegations that their products are meant to keep users hooked. Campaigners say it encourages addictive behaviour in adolescents, and that's resulted in both emotional and physical harms to them. That, as the debate on banning social media for under-16s heats up here. Well, Bruce Daisley worked at Twitter, including as its vice president from 2012 to 2020, and joins us now. Bruce, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can I just start by asking quite a personal question? What is your daily screen time on your phone?
Oh, my days. You know, I even turned off the screen time alert because I don't want to be reminded of it. I tend to view these things slightly more benign than maybe sort of the instinctive responses. You know, I love following news. I love using social media to punctuate dull moments of my life. But yes, definitely, I am an addictive user of these platforms as much as anyone else.
And it sounds so addicted that you don't actually want to know how many hours you're spending on your phone.
Yeah, in the same way that I don't think if someone told you you spent 2 hours reading the Sunday papers, you would view it in any way as a negative thing. You'd say, what a wonderfully carefree life I must have. And yeah, I don't want to have the data. But yeah, definitely, I use social media as much as the next person. I try not to make myself feel too guilty about it. But yeah, I'm as aware as everyone that these things maybe are something we want to limit at times.
So when you were at Twitter, was maximising screen time, making the app as addictive as possible, a priority?
To take one step back, it's really interesting the journey that tech platforms have been on. The reason why Google finds itself as one of the biggest companies in the world is that the founders of Google had a slightly different approach when they first set up the site. Their view was, we want to get people off Google as quickly as possible. And in comparison to the sites that came before it, the likes of Yahoo or Ask Jeeves, that tried to prolong your time on them, Google's discovery seemed to be that getting people off quicker made them come back more. That's certainly changed with social media platforms and tech platforms now. I think possibly one of the reasons why Twitter isn't one of the most used platforms in the world, or X isn't, is because it was slightly less accomplished at those things and didn't necessarily want to do some of the nefarious things that did increase your amount of time. So when I was working at Twitter, I left there before that guy took over. And when I was there, the average time that people were spending on Twitter was about 8 minutes a day, remarkably. If you compare that to some of the other platforms, though, Instagram was about an hour a day at that time, and TikTok was well over an hour. So social platforms do think about the time that we spend on them. They do try and optimize to ensure that that time is at a maximum. And they will look at every single point that might lead you to leave. So occasionally you'll see something like, if someone posts a link on some websites, on some of the social media apps, they quickly discover that that is downranked in the algorithm. And so they might say something like link in the comments rather than posting the link in the post. Yeah. And it's because these social apps go out of their way to try and maximize the time you spend rather than inviting you to leave the product.
Yeah, you mentioned nefarious tactics. Could you, I mean, I guess when you're using these apps, you are very attuned to identify them, and you mentioned a couple there. Can you tell us some others so that we might be able to sort of sense check when we're using social media what they are, which is why we're being lured in?
Yeah, so one of the first things that we all know about, or we hear about now, is that these products have an algorithm. And effectively, that is like a personalized bit of code that tries to understand what people are doing and second guess what other content to show them. So one of the first things that social apps will do is that if you post a new bit of content, they'll show it to 20 members of your closest friends and family to see if you watched it all the way through. The idea behind that is that if someone's got someone who's got an interest and a stake in the poster is watching it, then that's normally a good sign that strangers will watch it. And so very quickly, they'll show it to your friends. If your friends don't watch it all the way through, it will never make its way to strangers and other people on the app. Mm. And so they just try and second guess what is hot content, what is going to pass the muster of fellow users. Because they know if you've laid in bed and said, I'm going to watch three more TikToks or three more Instagram Reels, and you still find yourself 30 minutes later watching more, the more that they can make the content they put in front of you feel compelling, interesting, original, entertaining, they know that you're likely to hang around for longer and end up seeing more ads.
Yeah, well, we all do. Bruce, thank you. Bruce Daisley, the former vice president at Twitter. Listening to that conversation is Dr. Susie Davis, the GP mental health campaigner, who is a fierce campaigner for saying that children shouldn't be using their phones at school. And the education secretary today said that school should be a phone-free zone. Susie, listening to that analysis, we know that these apps are designed to keep us on there, but to hear it laid out, what was your reaction?
Well, I think it's fascinating, isn't it, to realise how addictive these apps are. But I think it goes so much more than that. We need to think that these tech bosses are spending huge amounts of money to make their apps as addictive as possible by hacking into our dopamine reward systems and also increasing the social validation that particularly young people are so desperate for. So I think it's actually more corrupt. I think it's darker than was maybe laid out, because these tech bosses know what they're doing. They know that they make money when our young people are spending their time and their attention on their apps. And they also know that it's not good for their well-being, but they're promoting them and the design features anyway.
Yeah, the government have launched a consultation as to whether they should be banning, like they have done in Australia, social media for under 16s. The Prime Minister has said on the record he's reluctant to ban apps for under 16s because he says what he's seen from his own children is that social media, using things like Instagram, has had an educational but also a social value of things like staying in touch with their friends. What do you think of the Prime Minister's case to say there is a positive side to social media that teenagers can be using?
Well, I think I would hope the Prime Minister is acting in the greater good for the country and for teenagers across the country. And whilst we all recognise there are some benefits of the online world and social media for connection for young people, what I'm seeing as a healthcare professional and what we're seeing increasingly in studies is that young people's mental health is being damaged. And I don't worry so much about the Prime Minister's children, but many of the children I care for in inner city Bristol, and again, evidence is showing it's the vulnerable children, the children who don't have any time restraints on their social media, who have unlimited access, who are having increasing mental health problems, self-harm, suicidal ideation, anxiety, depression. It's those children that I'm campaigning for, and I would urge the Prime Minister to act in the best interests of all children across the country and not just look at his two teenagers, but to take them, which I'm sure he is, but really to take a much, much bigger picture and to think, actually, how can we help teenagers across the UK have better mental health?
And that consultation is underway. Susie, thank you. Dr. Susie Davies, the GP and the mental health campaigner. I was talking to my youngest sister's 10 years younger than me, so she's quite a helpful way to kind of gauge something. She said her friend's been chatting about the fact that is there going to become a point where social media is so full of AI-generated rubbish, or AI slop as they call it, that we'll get fed up of going on social media, or is even the AI rubbish still just as addictive?
Well, it's a very good question, isn't it? I mean, can we try and find an old-fashioned metaphor or analogy there? If you had a car sitting outside your house, wouldn't you just go and drive in it wherever the destination was, even if some of the destinations were banned? Mm. If you're going to have a phone, I think it is going to be very difficult to not find things to do on it. It's the hardware as well as the software that's addictive, isn't it?
Yeah. More and more of my friends have got those apps now that make your phone look pretty as unappealing as possible. So everything in black and white disables pretty much all of your apps bar, sort of Maps and WhatsApp maybe. But it is such a battle, isn't it? Even for me, just to try and bring that weekly screen time alert down that you get on a Monday morning if you're an iPhone user, that is absolutely horrifying. And the horror of it is not enough really to radically change your behaviour.
Yeah. So sometimes I think it's not just the content within it that we're seeking to get pleasure from, is it? But I think anything's worth a go. That is very, very much my direction of travel as a parent. And I fully understand that we should always be critical of new policy that comes in. But actually, if one of the benefits of an under 16s ban is that the companies themselves start to direct their code, their algorithms, their marketing and their advertising at an older child, that is a good thing in and of itself. At the moment, they're just not. Right, coming up, we're going to open the doors of our literary salon and enter the intellectually fragrant Robbie Millen. We'll say hello after the latest news headlines with Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you very much. Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman has defected to Reform UK. The Fareham and Waterlooville MP says the Conservatives have no backbone and claim Britain is broken. It comes on the heels of Robert Jenrick switching 11 days ago. Mrs. Braverman used the opportunity at Reform event in central London to attack her former party.
When they're sat behind that table making the difficult decisions for the country, they fold. When push comes to shove, they go AWOL. No courage, no backbone, no resolve.
Sir Keir Starmer's defended the decision to block Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from putting his name forward for a by-election. The contest to select an MP in Gorton and Denton is being scheduled for the 26th of February. The remains of the last Israeli hostage held in Gaza have been recovered, paving the way to move to the next phase of the US-brokered ceasefire. Hamas says it provided mediators with necessary information to help find the body. Parts of the UK are braced for the latest named Met Office storm. Chandra is forecast to bring strong winds, heavy rain and snow tomorrow. Nigella Lawson says she's uncharacteristically rather lost for words after being named as a judge on the Great British Bake Off. She's replacing Dame Prue Leith, who's been a judge since the programme moved to Channel 4 in 2016. And with less than 2 weeks until the Six Nations gets underway, listen to the Ruck podcast for insight and analysis on the week's biggest rugby stories.
This is Times Radio.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Let the design and installation experts at Wix help transform your home. Get started by booking a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Time to get highbrow and enter our literary salon with The Times and the Sunday Times literary editor. Here he is, Robbie Millen.
The one I would like to talk about is Douglas Stewart. You remember he sort of won the Booker Prize in 2020. Don't let that put you off because it's a terrific novel. Came out in 2020 during the kind of the lockdown. And I thought Shaggy Bane was such a brilliant novel and so moving. You must have this occasion when you've been on stage interviewing an author. You can get a kind of vibe from the audience, and I've only had a feeling of overwhelming love coming towards the stage twice, and one of them was with him. You know, the audience was, he could have read my palm and the audience would have loved it. There was so much kind of adoration for him because I think everyone felt they'd been on a journey with him because Shaggy Bane, as you probably know, your listeners will know, is semi-autobiographical. It's about a boy who is growing up in a very neglectful, poor household in Glasgow. His mother's an alcoholic. And then, you know, once you do a bit of Googling around him, you can quickly discover a lot of this is lifted from his life, but he's put a fictional veil over it to give him a bit of space. So he had a second novel which came out, I think, 2 years ago called Young Mungo, which was a sort of similar milieu of kind of, rough urban Scotland. But he's now got a third novel out, and which I was really nervous about reading, because, you know, with certain writers, you think, I don't ever want you to write a Duff novel. I'd rather you stop than write something bad. But he's got one called John of John, which comes out in May, which thankfully is really first class, really good. And he's changed the sort of setting a bit to the Western Isles. I think it's the Isle of Harris. Is that right? Or is it Lewis? Oh, I'm terrible with my islands. Anyway, so sort of father and son relationship. Apologies to anyone in the Western Isles. There's a big difference, I know. But it's a story about father and the son, and the son has been away to a kind of fashion college, which, funny enough, Douglas Stewart, that was his big escape. You know, it was, I think, there's a Taxile College in the Borders, which he went to, and there he met lots of nice young posh Scottish girls, which was a novelty to him, and I think he found it very rewarding. Anyway, so this boy has returned from his period living in Edinburgh, a graduate, no job, comes back to live with his father, John. He's called Cow, John of John. He's actually called John Cow, but too much detail.
A strange lack of geographical detail, but a lot of other detail.
I've just looked at my notes. It is the Isle of Harris. Sorry about
Excellent.
That. Definitely the Isle of Harris. And his father is a crofter, God-fearing, wears his suits on Sunday and things like that. But they have a very awkward relationship. But there's all kinds of secrets. And one of the things I love about Douglas Stewart, he's literary, he can write, but he also gives you really satisfying stories where things happen.
Excellent. So that's coming out in
That's coming out May. In May.
Lovely.
And it's called John of John.
Maggie O'Farrell has a new novel called Land, which is coming out in June, and she's definitely booked on the podcast because obviously our listeners love her, and
yes,
we love her too. And we were trying to work out, we heard a rumour that Claire Chambers had another novel on
yes.
the way, but we couldn't find verification of this fact.
Do you want, if you can hum amongst yourself, I can quickly find my little list.
Oh, can you find your little list?
Yes. Tell you what, because we were talking a little earlier on about Daphne du Maurier.
Yeah.
There's another sequel coming up by Rose Tremain.
Ooh.
Exactly. She is brilliant.
Good. Yeah.
One of my favourite novels by Rose Tremain is Restoration. Do you remember that?
I don't remember Restoration. What was the one that she won the Women's Prize for? The Journey Home.
The Road Home was
the
it?
The Road Home.
That's
yeah.
right.
Which features the fantastic Lev as
That's
the
right.
really beautiful kind of Polish love interest.
That's right.
I've never forgotten Lev.
Oh, that's, you're looking all misty-eyed at me, as if I were Lev. Lev's levitating position. But that was, yes, because that was quite, interesting moment, because I think that was the beginning of the phase of sort of Eastern Europeans arriving, and no one had sort of written about, you know, these turning these people into sort of humans rather than just men that turn up
novel.
With plumbing kits.
So Rose Tremain is doing...
Yes.
Which of Daphne du Maurier's?
Well, it's a Rebecca.
It's
spin.
Another Rebecca.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
I know. So there's Anne Patchett. It's got a novel out in June with Whistler. I'm just looking at the big ones. She's very good, very popular. Okay, here we go. It's called The Housekeeper by Rose Tremain. Comes out in September.
That sounds like a Freda McFadden.
I know. Everyone's... jeepers, yes. Everyone's on that. Kate Atkinson's got a novel out on Noble Sales in September. So it's always the second half of the year is when it really happens. And then there's Meg Mason. At the end of August, she's got a novel coming out. Do you remember Meg Mason?
Sorrow and Bliss.
That's the fellow. Well, she's got a new one out in end of July.
What do you make of Freda McFadden? There was something in the way that you said that suggested you were a little bit po-faced about her.
Do you know what? I've got no right to judge because I've not read any of her books. We recently sort of ran a feature about her, her success, because... You know, any given week, she'll have four. Sometimes she once had five books in the top 10. So I mean, that's extraordinary. So she should be respected for that. I just suspect sometimes the storytelling, it may lack the nuance that I would probably go for.
Okay. I read one of hers because I was intrigued by her success. Yeah. And it was on a very long train journey. In fact, when we went up to North Berwick, Fringe by the Sea, and I just couldn't get enough of it. Yeah, I thought it was fantastic writing. I think she deserves her success. There. But it's interesting because I think you get to a level of success in those bestseller charts, and people with a more literary bent are put off, and that's just weird. I find that really weird.
It is one of the problems of working on a book success. You always have to be very aware of kind of intellectual snobberies, because sometimes the things we want to write about aren't necessarily what a lot of our readers or the reading public are looking at. So we're always aware of we're always waiting for the accusation of snobbery, because sometimes we are being a bit snobbish. Yeah.
And sometimes you'll see a book, described as dense and provocative.
That gets our heart going, doesn't it?
Walk away. Yeah, it means boring. Leave it on the desk.
The phrase you've always got to ignore, if you see it, take that as a great big warning. Hypnotic prose. Oof. That means boring. Yeah. And quite often with very literary novels, the words hypnotic prose is used.
Yeah, I don't like challenging either.
Oh, they're
anything that's challenging.
No, exactly. No. Epic just means long.
Yes, no, that's so true. Christopher Nolan is doing The Odyssey, isn't he?
Oh, gosh,
this summer.
His
movie comes out. and I did see somebody who clearly hadn't realised the nature of the epic poem that it was based on, saying, it's just going to be really long. It's kind of like, yes, but it's an epic poem.
You should call something an epic,
Right, are we done, do you think? Do you have other recommendations to make?
Well, do you ever want non-fiction?
Yes, always.
Well, I'm going to be interviewing Anthony Beaver, great military historian, which is probably not necessarily all your listeners, but he's written a great, quite short history of Rasputin. Remember, rah, rah, Rasputin,
Russia's greatest love machine.
Exactly. Which, there's a bit of truth to it about but it essentially sort of strips away some of the myths about him. Because there was always these things that he was sleeping with Emperor Nicholas II's wife, Alex, Queen Victoria's daughter. Too much background information. I don't know why I said that. a lot of that's not true. But the reason why Anthony Beaver's interesting, because can you think of someone else in history, someone from kind of peasant stock, basically illiterate, who had such an effect on world history? Because without Rasputin and, getting close to the Romanovs, the ruling family of Russia, they probably wouldn't have collapsed. So it's this kind of, he's a really interesting man, and Anthony Beaver's a brilliant historian, so it's worth looking at. And I think that comes out in March. I mean, Russian history is very depressing. Mm.
Well, I think that's one.
Sorry, recommend that.
Light relief. Yes, a little light relief. You can hear more of that conversation if you'd like to download the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast, where Robbie and I and young Eve, we rambled on for a good half an hour about books, one of our favourite topics. We were discussing John of John by Douglas Stewart and Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs by Anthony Beaver.
John Pienaar will be here in 15 minutes' time, but coming up before then, we're going to be joined by our money man, Adam Shaw, about what could become your next side hustle. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Times Radio Breakfast is back in the morning from 6 a.m.
Ni hao!
We've just learnt that's how you say hello in Chinese.
I'm just trying to get into the spirit of it. Keir Starmer goes to China tomorrow. We're going to consider what he could achieve there. Is it a good idea for him to be there at all?
And what might the repercussions be? We'll ask our panel, because from 9 o'clock, our leaders William Hague and Kezia Dugdale will talk through the news of the day.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Gable.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love. the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit OceaniaCruises.com or your travel agent.
This is Times Radio.
It's 3:47. Now, there are about 2.8 million people who run a side hustle renting out a property in the buy-to-let market. Together, they earn around £47 billion a year. So, on average, they are each earning around £17,000 a year. Not to be sneezed at. But that money doesn't come easily. Renting out properties has become more difficult over the past few years. So it's good to know some of the hidden problems would-be landlords should be aware of. And sorry, of course,
you couldn't possibly get the words out.
Our money man Adam Shaw is here to explain. Adam, after
I tell you, buy to let often does that.
Float your boat, obviously.
Joking over my words. Right, explain, Adam. Yes. This used to be something pretty lucrative if you had spare cash. Mm. Why is it not so anymore?
Yeah, it used to be a bit of a slam dunk, I agree. And it's become a lot harder. Now, those numbers come from the Inland Revenue, and it's those buy-to-let landlords who aren't incorporated, so haven't caused a business. So it is more sort of side hustle. It's become harder, I think, because, and it will become even harder as new legislation comes in over the next few months, which has already been enacted but has yet to actually take effect, which places more emphasis on the responsibilities of landlords. So you're facing a problem, lots of increased costs, more legislation, and it's squeezed the landlord market. I mean, there's two sides to this coin. Of course, that means that tenants are better protected. And we often talk about house prices, constantly talking about house prices. I think we very rarely talk about rental prices, and that's a huge chunk of the market. So, you know, what's good for one side might be poor for the other side, but taken in the round, I agree, it's not been so great. And there are lots of responsibilities now. And I think people forget that. They go, oh, I've got a bit of money, I'll buy a buy-to-let, it'll run itself. It's not like chucking it into an investment fund. Lots of responsibilities, legal responsibilities. You've got to have an apartment or a flat property that's safe and free from health hazards. You've got to have safety checks on your gas equipment. You've got to have energy performance certificates. You've got to make sure you're renting to people who have a right to rent. So lots of legal legislation on you as well. And I should say this is a devolved matter, so rules are slightly different in Scotland and Northern Ireland. I'm mainly talking about England here. I think actually in Scotland in particular, I think it's a lot more restrictive and protective of tenants.
And the Renters' Rights Bill comes in, yes, in, I can't exactly, May, is it this year?
Yeah, that's right. It's enacted, and I think certain of the big rollouts come out in May. And the big thing there for both tenants and landlords is the end of the fixed lease. So it used to be I rent to you and I say to you, well, you can stay in the flat for a year. Even if that is now in place, that will become void after this becomes enacted. And it's a rolling tenancy so that the tenant can give notice at any period, but the landlord can't just go, I don't want to rent to you anymore, I'd like to rent to somebody else. Can't do that. There are very restricted ways of actually getting a tenant out. You might want to sell the property. I think you can, if you want to move in yourself, I think that might be one of the exemptions. But they're rather restricted. So the tenant has a lot more rights and the landlord is much more restricted.
And talking about that sort of the sides of the coin, for the tenant, excellent news for them about the fact that their rent can't go up substantially, but bad news for the landlord who can't just hike the rents.
Okay, so I take issue, a little bit of an issue with that. So it's not so much the rent can't go up a lot, I think, although you're right, but it's more complex. It's that the big, easy-to-understand rule is that you can only raise the rent once a year. So that's first thing. Now, to your point, well, how much can it rise by? There's no strict cap on how much it can rise by, but I think that in the legislation, it is that it has to be a market rate. So it sort of has to be reasonable given the context. And if not, there is an ombudsman to go to. So you're right, the tenant has some more security. And I've spoken to lots of long-term tenants who spend their life renting and go, I built a life out of this. I'm not a student, or I'm not 18 or 20, or whatever it is. I'm a middle-aged person who rents, and yet I have no security. You know, we could be thrown out tomorrow. And I think the Renters' Rights Act has really come to address that issue. And it does that, seems to do that very effectively, but it's an issue for landlords.
Yeah, or worse, you've kind of got a family and children in schools, and you've got no security to say that, you know, that's going to be the place that you can bring up your family for the duration of their school careers, for example.
Correct. So there's a social issue to this, and that's what that act was meant to address. But of course, it restricts your flexibility as a landlord. And the concern is, and I don't quite think this has been played out, but there's lots of concern about this, that actually the response might cause problems in that people will go, oh, hold on a second, I don't want to wrap my money in this flat and then not be able to get rid of a tenant. Therefore, what will happen to the supply of rental accommodation is something that people will be talking about, will see play out.
And what do you think will happen there? If it basically becomes more expensive and less attractive to be a buy-to-let landlord, does that do what I guess you might hope is that, okay, it's going to mean there'll be more houses on the market and greater availability for those people who want to try and get that first step on the ladder?
I am confused by the data I see is frankly my answer to that. Lots of talk about people going, well, I'm just coming out of the market. And I saw some figures which seem to support that, which would restrict the supply and actually cause problems for tenants. But the latest numbers and talk I've seen seems to make it not as dramatic as we first feared. But as you said right at the beginning, lots of these rules have yet to come actually into play. So I think this is something we will watch over the next 2 years or so, because these tend to be long-term decisions. But that's certainly a worry that what was intended to be helpful to tenants may in the long run not be helpful to tenants. If investors go, this is my money, this is my pension, if you like. Lots of people I know going, well, I haven't got a pension, I've sort of got a buy-to-let, that's going to be my pension. Well, if I can't get rid of someone, if the government's going to restrict me, why would I do that? So this is a really difficult issue.
What advice would you be giving to someone who's got spare income, who had up until now been debating to say, OK, well, should I buy that property? What would you be saying they should consider before actually purchasing?
There are lots of hidden costs which you don't see right at the beginning. First of all, using an estate agent. You can get an estate agent to just collect the rent. So you're also not dealing with the tenant, really. That will cost you, can cost you between 5 and 10%, these agency fees. And or you can get them to go deal with everything. So if the washing machine breaks down or whatever, they will deal with everything. And I think it's expensive for what it provides, because in essence, if, for instance, your tenant doesn't pay, the estate agent doesn't go round there and shake them until the money comes out. They sort of send a few emails. Well, that's an expensive way of sending emails. So, but the cost of the estate agent is important. But there's lots of other costs, maintenance costs. There's landlord's insurance. I think the big thing is void periods. Your whole analysis of whether this makes money for you, you'll go, well, I get a tenant in and they pay X amount and I times that by 12. That covers my mortgage and here's my little profit. Well, what if you don't get a tenant for a month? And I've seen lots of buy-to-let landlords, their whole sort of basis of investment gets thrown out the window because it took a month to get a tenant in. And during that month, you're still paying your mortgage. So you've got to really...
What kind of margin are you suggesting you should look at then to say within that margin, it's still profitable?
It's impossible to give you a precise figure for everyone, because it depends on your financial flexibility elsewhere. If this is everything and this has got to make you money, I mean, the issue here is when you had a year tenancy, you might go, I'll build in 1 month void period, because if the tenant's only going to stay a year, maybe it might take me 2 or 3 weeks to get a new tenant. Well, that's a month gone. Now you've got rolling tenancies. You're not sure when the tenant will leave. They might leave at any point. So I still think if you can build in a month a year, that would be brilliant. But at least you should work out what that would do to your finances if you can't get a tenant in. The other thing is deposit protection. Generally, I think a good thing. I rented lots of times when I was younger, and I think I'm right in saying every time I stayed in a rented accommodation, the landlord took my deposit, and I always felt that was unjustified. There is now a much better system of regulation. But the big thing for people is tax.
Because landlords did have a big tax advantage, which they've lost. Can you explain that?
Yes, you used to basically be able to deduct the cost of your mortgage off the profit. So you had a mortgage, that reduced your profit, you had now a smaller profit, and that's what you got taxed on. That has gone, and that was particularly difficult. Sorry, it is now particularly difficult for those on higher rate tax, so if you're paying 40% or so. So that's gone, and what you now get in its place is a 20% tax credit on the mortgage interests you pay. So it gets a bit technical and boring.
I was about to say, my brain didn't quite...
Well, I think your brain worked it out, but your eyes were closing. So I could see that going. I was losing my one audience member. I have written this up, I have to say, in more detail as ever.
And this is really the intricacies of someone's thinking about it.
This is someone's thing.
So it's not as lucrative from a tax perspective as it used to be.
So effectively, certainly if you're a higher rates taxpayer, you used to get 40% off. You now get a 20% tax credit on your mortgage payments. The bottom line of that is ignore all of that detail. It's not as good as it was. It can cause real problems. In fact, I know one person who's a buy-to-let landlord with one property who makes a loss, so whose mortgage payments are higher than the rent they get, but still gets taxed.
Can I just say one final thing before I let you go, Adam? It is nearly the end of January.
Yes.
For anyone who hasn't done their tax return yet, could you just give them a little bit of extra motivation not to leave it until Saturday?
Yes, listen to me. Do your tax return. This is Daddy Adam Shaw telling you. Thank
you. Must do it today.
Have you not done yours?
I've done it, but I haven't yet paid it.
Okay.
You've got to pay it. Yes, that's a good point. Don't just do it. Pay it. That was a public service announcement.
And you'll feel so happy when you've done it. So there we go.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Is it called swallowing the frog syndrome? Yes, you just got to do the very big bad thing at the beginning of the year. Yeah. And for an awful lot of us, it is a tax return.
Or do it 6 months ago. That's also an option. But some people do that.
No, you're quite right. We always say, oh, do it this week. You go, no, you should have done it ages ago.
Adam, thank you. You can find out more at themoneydoctor.tv. Adam Shaw, the business journalist.
I think we've just made people feel really bad. I'm so sorry about that. More of that tomorrow between 2 and 4. And our guest will be Amanda Owen, the Yorkshire Shepherdess. So we'll look forward to that, a little bit of taking you out of a dark and dirty world, we hope. Our producer today was Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. From Rosie and from me, have a lovely evening. Up next, John Pienaar.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Rosie. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Suella Braverman, the former Conservative Home Secretary, defects to Reform UK. And the Gorton and Denton by-election will take place on February the 26th, after the resignation of Andrew Gwynne last week. And with politics, well, as fraught as ever and more so, I'll be talking to two Labour MPs with very different views on Keir Starmer's future after he was acted to block Andy Burnham's bid to return to Westminster. And as the Tories suffer another Reform defection, I'll be talking to a former mayor who wants more centrism in the Tory party. And the Home Secretary will be setting out her policing reforms in the House of Commons. Well, any moment now. We'll be bringing that to you live.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Suella Braverman's become the latest high-profile Conservative to defect to Reform. The former Home Secretary's told a party event in central London that it feels like she's come home. She claims Britain is broken and said the Conservatives have no backbone.
We stand at a crossroads. We can either continue down this route of managed decline to weakness and surrender, or we can fix our country, reclaim our power, rediscover our strength.
Times Radio's chief political commentator Patrick Maguire has said he's surprised she's been accepted given historic opposition to the move from within Reform.
I'm surprised it's happened because I think there was an awareness for a long time at the top of Reform that they couldn't become a retirement home for people associated with the failures of the last Conservative government, particularly on migration. Mm. And it's hard to argue that a former Tory Home Secretary puts clear turquoise water between Reform and those failures. That is one perspective.
Meanwhile, a date's been set for the Gorton and Denton by-election. It'll take place on the 26th of February after the government moved a writ to officially start the process of replacing Andrew Gwynn, who resigned last week. Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham won't be standing for Labour after being blocked by the party's National Executive Committee. The remains of the final Israeli hostage in Gaza have been recovered. 24-year-old police officer Ran Gvili was killed fighting Hamas during the October 7th attacks in 2023. Speaking in December, his parents held out some optimism he'd be returned, possibly alive.
You don't know where he is, what's going on in your mind, but we are strong and we believe he will come back. And we hope he will come alive.
We want hope. So we want to
have a little bit of hope. So
miracle.
The return of all living and deceased hostages fulfills a key condition of the initial phase of President Trump's plan to end the Gaza war. An asylum seeker has been found guilty of raping a woman in a park in Nottinghamshire. The victim, who a court heard was drunk and obviously vulnerable, was attacked in Sutton in Ashfield last June. Jurors convicted 28-year-old Shiraz Malik of two counts of rape, clearing him of a third. A sentencing date is expected to be set next month. Deaf people are being forced to turn off their hearing aids because of a nationwide shortage of batteries within the NHS. GP surgeries and hospital audiology departments are rationing batteries. Patients with hearing impairments are restricted to one pack per week and must return to the hospital for more supplies. They would normally be handed several packs lasting a few months to save them repeated visits. And Nigella Lawson will replace Dame Prue Leith as a judge on the next series of The Great British Bake Off. Dame Prue was hired after the series jumped from the BBC to Channel 4 in 2016. And remember, the finest writers from The Times preview and review the week's football. That's on The Game podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, today there's an interval in the psychodrama, the power play over the leadership of Labour and the country, a pregnant pause. Andy Burnham is saying his full focus is now on being Mayor of Manchester, so presumably not at all on replacing Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer says he stopped Burnham running for a parliamentary seat to save Labour money and campaigning effort with local elections coming up. And if you believe a word of any of that, with great respect, you will believe anything. On today's show, I'm going to be talking live to Labour MPs and Labour watchers, testing out an alternative and, to me, compelling and persuasive take on what's really going on. It is that Keir Starmer is toast. The Prime Minister and his team have thrown an obstacle in Andy Burnham's path, and the PM is hoping now to somehow recover lost trust and reunite his party. But in fact, one thing that unites Labour MPs, like most past Labour voters, is that Starmer has lost it. And the question now is not whether the PM faces a leadership challenge, just when and who takes part, apart from Wes Streeting, that is, because while we're watching the fallout land and resentment build over the Starmerite operation to stop Burnham, it is a very good idea to watch Wes. I hate to sound like a cynic, because I'm honestly not one, but when Wes Streeting next pledges his loyalty to Keir Starmer and his uninterest in replacing him as leader, we really shouldn't believe a single word of that either. What do you think? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So here then is Keir Starmer defending the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing in the coming by-election.
Andy Burnham's doing a great job as the Mayor of Manchester, but having an election for the Mayor of Manchester when it's not necessary would divert our resources away from the elections that we must have and that we must fight and win. And resources, whether that's money or people, need to be focused on the elections that we must have, not elections that we don't have to have. And that was the basis of the NEC decision.
And that was Keir Starmer. Andy Burnham, meanwhile, made light of the situation as he addressed a Centre for Social Justice education event this morning.
I've said everything I think I'm going to say about that today. I'm very much
focusing on my job.
And that was Andy Burnham. Now let's say hi to Oliver Wright, the policy editor at The Times. Hi to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Hi, Ollie. So an obstacle thrown in Andy Burnham's path, but it's true and fair to say, isn't it, that Keir Starmer's basic position is no stronger now?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. And as you pointed out, that you know, while it is valid for Starmer to say that they didn't want to have an election to replace Andy Burnham in Manchester, that they don't have the money to fight that election, and they're very fearful that Reform could actually, you know, take control of one of Britain's great cities, there was another motivation, and that motivation was to prevent Andy Burnham returning to Westminster and being able to launch a leadership bid against Starmer.
Yeah, and Ollie, I mean, I don't know, you might guess that Keir Starmer and his lieutenants will maybe want to tie Burnham as closely into the campaign to hold the seat in Gordon as possible, where he's been blocked, because it will just tie him to whatever happens next, and what happens next may not be very good at all for Labour.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there will be not so subtle attempts to get Andy Burnham to be a prominent feature of that campaign and to go on a regular number of visits to the constituency in the run-up to the poll later next month. But, yeah, I think if you talk to people in private within Labour, you know, they don't think they are going to hold the seat. I mean, they face this sort of double threat. You know, you've got Reform that came second at the last election, and then you have the Greens that came third. And, you know, the Greens certainly fancy their chances. Yeah. They think that if they run a strong campaign, they have enough people in the constituency, that actually it could be them rather than the Reform that are the beneficiaries. Now, you know, Labour loyalists say, well, we need to get there. We need to have a ground game. We need to be the principal opposition to Reform. But certainly, you know, there is a world in which Labour is pushed into third place behind both Reform and the Greens.
Right, and if we're anticipating, you know, the impact of what is coming, I mean, Gorton holding that is going to be incredibly hard.